Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
With over 1.7 billion Muslims spread across a diverse religious spectrum in an age defined all too often by global conflict and Islamophobia, what does it mean to be a, quote, good Muslim? Our next guest is Omar Saif Gobash, the ambassador of the United Arab Emirates to Russia. His new book of personal essays, Letters to a Young Muslim, seeks to carve out a space for Muslim individualists to live in harmony with the modern world. Ambassador Gobash, welcome to WNYC.
Thank you very much for having me on your show.
If you have questions for the ambassador as we talk, give us a call at 212-433-WNYC. That's 212-433-9692. Ambassador, you write that, quote, the idea of the Muslim individual is the simplest and most effective unit for the regeneration of the Muslim world. What is Muslim individualism, and why do you think that is such an important thing to start talking about?
Well, to be honest, it took me quite a long time to come to that conclusion. I mean, the set of questions really started when I was about 12 years old. I'm 45 now. And it was being a good Muslim in the world that I was brought up in always involved some kind of loyalty to a greater cause, a greater group, the idea of the Muslim Ummah. And, of course, the Muslim Ummah is the idea of the global Islamic community, a very important idea. But from my perspective, it hadn't been really clarified what exactly global Islamic community meant. And I still have difficulty really finding the details in my reviews of theological literature or religious literature. And I actually think that there's a very important element here that we need to focus on our individual perspectives, really to be able to talk about individual morality, individual ethics, and to hold ourselves responsible at the individual level.
And so in the Ummah, that the Muslim Ummah that you're talking about, you've also said that this is an idea that's been hijacked by certain groups and to some end, right?
Well, to say that it's hijacked, it was there to be taken, essentially. It's up for grabs. And because we don't have clarity on exactly what the Ummah consists of and how different elements of the global Islamic community are meant to come together, how the Ummah really integrates into a modern world, we're still using 7th century concepts that haven't been fully developed. And I think that, you know, there is no harm in having a concept of a global Islamic community. I mean, you have a global Christian community, you have the Jewish community, you have various faiths. But what I find interesting is that we need to be thinking about what exactly it means to have a global community and what obligations we might have towards the global entity and what obligations the global community would have to the individual. In a certain sense, what I noticed over the last few years was that there's this vague concept of an ummah, and that it has certain interests. And actually, those interests then are defined as territorial or financial, or there's a sense in which the global Islamic community is under attack. It's almost disembodied from the lives of ordinary Muslims. So what I want, really, is to have some clarity there. And part of the clarity comes from establishing the notion of a Muslim individual. And it's in that relationship between the individual with a clear sense of him or herself, that we can begin to think about the Ummah.
Mm-hmm. And what do you mean within the context of all this by when you say the burden of privilege? What do you mean by this?
I was talking about myself, the burden of privilege. I mean, I come from a very well-off family. And we live in a country that has benefited from hydrocarbons, oil, and gas. And so, in a sense, that we in our part of the Middle East, we have a very privileged lifestyle. We don't deal with hunger. We don't deal with poverty. We have, you know, access to the best health care. We have access to excellent education. And so, in that sense, I think that we, within the Middle East, those who are extraordinarily privileged, should be giving something back. back, should be contributing, should be making sacrifices to lift the rest of the Arab world, at least, and the Middle East up. And, you know, even more broadly, I think there's a very, very basic problem that we have in our part of the world and in the Muslim community is that the high levels of illiteracy. And some people say that some reports suggest that 70% of the Muslim world is illiterate. And I think that is a tragedy that needs to be resolved.
Hmm. And I mean, I would imagine that part of the privilege that you're describing there is also the privilege of to develop an individualism, right? That that it's easier to exist outside of a community, outside of a outside of a community that you may depend upon for resources.
Yeah, absolutely, I agree. I would say that wealthier communities have that greater possibility. What is also interesting is that I've spent a lot of time with people who are really not as privileged as I am, who do really live hand to mouth, and I find that actually with the rise of technologies like Facebook and Twitter and Instagram in particular, that there is an inevitable opening up of the individual simply because people are now being able to, they're able to identify themselves with a particular kind of structure. And I find it interesting that people are now comparing themselves with other people on social media in order to it's almost a competition of individuality, and I'm very excited by that. I think that that is a kind of a subtle but very powerful mechanism to bring the individual out into the open.
Listeners, particularly our Muslim listeners, if you would like to ask Ambassador Gobash a question about Muslim individualism or have a comment about it, give us a call at 212-433-WNYC. That's 212-433-9692. So, you know, there exists an incredible diversity in Islam, as you know, as you've written about. There is, you know, everything from Shia to Sunni and extremist ideas of fundamentalist Islam and Boko Haram to mystical Sufis. What's the common element here, though? What unifies all of this?
Well, that's what is so interesting about living in this particular period. I can imagine if you went back 100 years or 200 years or even to the 10th century, that because of the inability to really travel quickly and because knowledge and information traveled so slowly, it was very difficult. It was very easy to be locked up in your own particular interpretation. I think the challenge for Muslims in the 21st century is to really answer that question. What is it that actually binds all of these different perspectives? And one of the things that's happening is that a lot of people will say, well, all of the other manifestations of Islam are incorrect. The one that I am in favor of is the only version of true Islam. And I think that actually we need to begin to think openly about what it might mean that we're actually expressing Islam in a different way, even if the basics are the textual foundations are the same. There are so many ways in which you can express this through your human behavior. And when it comes to the question of the radical groups, this is where we really need to remember that we're human beings and that we need to think, does this really make sense to be so violent or aggressive or exclusive in our understanding of Islam? Does that actually make sense? And are we doing Islam a service by taking a very radical and narrow view of Islam? And I think that my personal conclusion after so many years of thinking about this is that there is a certain basic humanity, and that humanity has to be compatible, or rather, Islam is by necessity compatible with that humanity. And if you come up with an interpretation that really offends your own sense of humanity, then you're on the wrong track.
You write about understanding the Muslim world as a pyramid in the book. Why is that? How explain that idea?
Well, I know that there are certain Muslim thinkers who have come out and said, look, you know, I mean, and this is brought up in the context of Islamophobia, that there's only a tiny percentage of Muslims who are extremist. The vast majority are very peaceful. And so that is true. However, who has an agenda? And it is the extremists who have the agenda, and it is the extremists who have a very clear understanding of their own identity and where they want to take Islam. And one of the problems that I've been trying to deal with over the last few years is how do we actually begin to put into words what it is to be a moderate Muslim? Why is violence something that we should think about very carefully? Even though, you know, you can always point to texts or verses in the Quran or in the prophetic sayings that seem to sanction violence. So what I really wanted to do was to have a kind of a better understanding. And so the pyramid approach is to say that, yes, the bulk of the pyramid is very peaceful, but it doesn't really know where it's going. And it's the ones with the agenda who are right at the top who are pushing a very simplistic, reductive understanding of Islam, which unfortunately includes violence in certain contexts.
As I imagine, I don't have to tell you, within the U.S. political context, the conversation about what role do individual Muslims play in relationship to radical Islam, to terrorism, and what are their responsibilities for that is quite a heated conversation.
Of course, yes.
And you know, and I think, you know, the analogy that folks use, that I use, is, you know, I'm a Christian. No one asks me to explain my Christianity in relationship to other Christians' behavior.
Sure.
Are these different concepts? How are they different? How do we understand this?
Well, I know that there are many people in the West, many Muslims in the West, who have come out and said, look, you know, I'm a Muslim. I'm a normal human being. I get on with everybody in my community. I don't discriminate against, you know, non-Muslims. And in a sense that this is, you know, this is great. But does it have a philosophical foundation? Does it have a theological foundation? Does it have a set of arguments that allows, you know, the individual Muslim in the West just get on with his life, his or her life? I have taken a different position, both in the Middle East and abroad, and I think to myself, well, we do operate from the same texts. You know, to compare ourselves with other religions is interesting, but it's an avoidance of a sense of responsibility. And I would prefer to take full responsibility for the direction of certain elements of certain groups within Islam. The fact is that in my personal experience, the arguments against radical Islam have not really been sort of strong enough. In my mind. And I want to be able to see the more traditional clerics and more traditional kind of Muslims come out and not make excuses, not apologize, but to think openly and clearly in the Muslim community and outside of the Muslim community about what it means to have violence in certain parts of the community. So I'm more in favor of taking responsibility I would say doing more than simply denouncing violence and saying that Islam is a religion of peace. We actually need to work out the details of how it is a religion of peace, what that peace means to us today, what violence, how to deal with the violence that is certainly a part of the texts of Islam. And I'd like to add here that, you know, there are many religions that have texts that refer to violence. We need to work through the real meaning of violence in the 21st century. And I would hope that we can come up with interpretations that say that violence of a certain kind was relevant in a certain context in the 7th century or the 8th century or the 9th century. But in the 21st century, there are so many more interesting ways in which we can deal with issues relating to, you know, the safety of the community.
I want to go to Omar in Paramus, New Jersey. Omar, how are you?
Hi, good afternoon, guys. How are you?
Good morning. Hey, good morning.
Hi, so I'd like to make a point about the Muslim Ummah that the author is discussing. From my understanding, as being a Muslim, is that Ummah is, as Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, had said, that Ummah is like one body. And we are all part of the body. So if one part of the body feels the pain, the rest of the body feels. If one part of the body feels the pain, the rest of the body feels the pain as well. So we share all the pain of the body. So we look out for each other, whether it's socio-political or economic means. That's the concept that I understand as part of being the Ummah. It's nothing complicated. And as far as the part that you're talking about, where the scholars aren't condemning enough, well, I think I disagree. I think vast majority, 99.9%, if not 100% of all the academic scholars in the U.S. have come out against any further any form of violence, and they have come out strongly against it. The problem exists in these Middle Eastern countries, where you have these scholars, self-proclaimed scholars, not academic scholars, where they go out and they further their agenda by dividing the people. So and by in vast majority everywhere in the world, academic scholars have come out against violence in any way, shape, or form.
So thank you, Umar.
That's the point that I wanted to make.
Thank you for that, Umar. Ambassador, you sounded like you wanted to jump in there.
Yes, I did. I understand, of course, the prophetic traditions on the Ummah. What I'm saying is that we need a little more clarity. These were very broad statements, so that the Muslim people are one body, and if one part of the body feels pain, then we all feel pain. This is absolutely true. But I'd like to sort of put forward a slight problem that I think needs to be resolved, and it can be resolved with our Islamic concepts. But for example, if you look at the leading traditional authorities of Islam within the Arab world, within the Sunni Arab world, and you look at the specific way in which they have condemned ISIS, for example, they condemn ISIS's actions, but they don't say ISIS doesn't represent Islam or is not a Muslim organization, because the reason they don't do that is that the members of ISIS have actually made the step to declare their Islam, which is to declare the Shahada, which means that they believe in Allah and the Prophet. They may have a seriously misguided understanding of Allah and the Prophet, but they say it. And so that, effectively, by the technical standards of being a Muslim, members of ISIS are Muslims. And so what I want to understand is, well, if we are a global Islamic community and members of ISIS and other terrible organizations can also claim legitimately in front of our traditional authorities that they are also Muslims, well, must I feel their pain when they're being bombed? I don't know that I should. And I would prefer to have real clarity on what it means to be a worthy Muslim, because people can say whatever they want about being a Muslim, but are they worthy of my attention? Are they worthy? Is it important enough for me to go and sacrifice the life that I'm building up for a group of people who I believe are insane?
Well, we will have to leave it on that note, Ambassador. Omar Saif Gobash, who is the ambassador of the United Arab Emirates to Russia, he has a new book of personal essays, Letters to a Young Muslim. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much.
After the break, the big screen. What have you seen? What should you be seeing? I'll be right back.